Welcome to Opening Presents, the podcast about creative self-realization. My name is Aaron Robinson. Thank you so much for joining me. In today's episode, I have the honor of sitting down with one of my favorite photographers, Ivan McClellan. In this conversation, we discuss his earliest creative influences, and he pulls back the curtain and brings us into 8 Seconds, a project that pays tribute to an American icon, the Black Cowboy. Over the last number of years, Ivan has traveled across the country to Black rodeos, taking photos, creating relationships, and telling the stories of these men and women who keep tradition alive by laying it all on the line. I believe Ivan is creating some of the most important work of this time, and I want to thank him, his wife Heather, and most importantly, I want to thank all of the cowboys and cowgirls out there for staying true and sharing your soul for 8 Seconds. If you enjoy this episode, make sure to share it with a friend. Now, without further ado, welcome to Opening Presents. Welcome to Opening Presents. My name is Aaron Robinson. Today I have a very, very special guest. Let me introduce you to Ivan McClellan.
Thanks for having me on, man. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, so this is cool. Yeah.
No, yeah. It's like I've been following you on Instagram for a while, and we've sent a couple messages here and there. But first off, I'm just like a huge, huge fan of your work. Like it stands alone, and I know we'll dive into that. But since this is our first time ever meeting, could you just give our listeners kind of like an overview of like who you are and like where you came from?
Yeah. Thanks so much for that. I work in a vacuum most of the time. So like that people enjoy this just blows my mind every time. Like, you know about me? That's crazy.
No, it's hard.
Ivan McClellan. I am a photographer and a designer based out of Portland, Oregon. I'm originally from Kansas City, Kansas. And I moved out here about 10 years ago to pursue my design and my photography career. And, you know, just like built things up really slow, really got my skills up for a long time. Worked kind of in silence. I was doing street photography for years. So I was just sort of like lurking around downtown, like taking pictures of people. And that like got me really, really good, really sharpened and refined my vision. And around that same time, I discovered Black cowboys and started shooting rodeos around the country. And I've just done that for 6 years. And it, you know, in the last like 2 years has kind of taken off and has become like my central focus of my work. It's all that I shoot. So, you know, you go onto my Instagram or my website and you just like kind of can look at this entire world and really like kind of dive into it. So that's what I'm focused on.
That's awesome. And before we dive into like Black cowboys, cause it's like, it's a huge subject, and especially in like the, I guess like the collective consciousness of America. And then even as like Black Americans, it's like, it's something that we've always had like this longing to exist as. It's like, I want to be on the horse and I want to be that person. And it's just like, no, like these people actually exist. And there's a whole culture with it. But going back to growing up in Kansas and your first explorations in design and photography, and how did you enter kind of like this arena of expressing yourself creatively?
It was always a part of my narrative. It's part of my family's narrative. You know, my mom wanted to be a fashion designer, and she would draw like pictures of clothes like all the time. So like growing up, we just had like art pencil sets and notebooks everywhere. And I would sneak and use our art pencil sets, and I would get in trouble for that. And she finally figured out that she couldn't like stop me from drawing. So she started to like coach me and like really give me constructive feedback about what I was drawing. So I was like drawing a superhero, and she's like, the proportions are off on this. Like, you know, if this person was standing straight on, they would be 10 feet wide. Like your light sources aren't coming from the same place. Like, you know, your pencil technique is crazy. Like your shading is ridiculous. You need to blend that. And I'm like six,
blend
seven.
That shit.
I'm like six, seven. And she's like really, really talking to me about like perspective and stuff like this. So I got to be very, very good at drawing like pretty early on. And, you know, my school teachers were just like, what is going on? Like, this kid is crazy. And then I got into like music. Like, I was in a choir at church. You know, you kind of had to do that as a kid. So I sang in the church growing up, and then, you know, started doing solos, and then got into that in school, went to state competitions, you know, got really nice at singing. Ended up going to a performing arts college in New York for singing and acting. My grandma was a computer programmer for TWA airline. And so we always had computers in the house, and, you know, she taught us how to do that. So coding was a part of my upbringing. And like, as soon as the internet came, I was making websites, I was making GeoCities sites, like, so that was a part of my upbringing. I ended up doing that for a living. So it's just like every creative expression, every creative media was like encouraged in the house. My sister's a big time dancer. She's a hairdresser. Like, all of us, you know, were just like, if you have something creative to say, like, say it loud and do it with excellence. And that was sort of really encouraged in our family.
Wow. That's so rare. And what a blessing to like have the encouragement to like pursue art and pursue expression, because it's like a lot of the times we're encouraged to minimize like our own personal perspective and our own voice, and to hear yes, I mean, like the initial aversion for you to draw that was short-lived, until it was like, no, if you want to be about this, then this is how you're gonna do it. And like, don't we all wish that we have that? When did, so going through all these different mediums and expressions, like, what is it that made you gravitate towards photography? Because it's like, when you're sketching things out, there's like a very, I guess like mechanical, like part of it. It's like, not a lot of it is left up to chance.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not like, oh yeah, I'm like out here living and then I'm capturing like this energetic moment. But like with drawing and stuff, it's like you have time to kind of whittle and craft and erase and come back and forth. But in photography, it's like there's that one split second moment. But yeah, like, explain kind of like your introduction to photography.
Yeah, I think, you know, it started out early. My uncle was a photographer. He went to Vietnam and he got his first camera, and he came home, and, you know, I think he really used photography as a way of healing.
Yeah.
He used photography to like sort of connect with the world that he felt uncomfortable in. And so he would just sort of sit at family gatherings and stuff and just take pictures of people. He wouldn't talk to anybody. He was just like there with his camera. And I was always curious about that. My mom, you know, being into fashion and stuff like that, we would always have photographers around like shooting like prototypes that they had or doing like model shoots at the house, stuff like that. My mom was very beautiful. She would model. And so all of her guy friends were photographers, Ray Jackson, Brian Egan's, like all of these guys like shot like, you know, headshots. They shot prom photos. Like, they just were like hustling photography. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really grow up with a dad. So these men around me, all being photographers, I sort of was like, that's what men do. You know, men snap those photos. And so as soon as I got my hands on a camera, it just felt really natural. And it felt really like something that was part of my like upbringing, something that was dignified and respectful and stuff like that. I didn't really come around to like being a photographer and acknowledging that that could be a career and be like my central medium of expression until about like 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, I was an actor for most of my 20s. And then I got into like digital media because I was like tired of like being broke. And so I started like doing websites and stuff like that. And when I was doing websites, I felt like, this is the least creative thing that I could possibly be doing. I was doing email marketing. I was doing like stuff that was really business driven and didn't have a lot of creative flexibility to it. And so I went to, this is a long story with a lot of turns, but I went to Istanbul. And when I went there, I borrowed a camera from a friend. And I, you know, didn't know how to use it. He was teaching me how to use it on complete manual. Because he was like, if you use any of the auto modes, like, you're cheating. And that's not going to make a good photo. And so I went to Istanbul, had no clue what I was doing. And I ended up at a soccer game. And I had my camera with me. And I took a picture of this guy that was chanting. And it just like, I looked at the back of the camera and it was in focus and it was colorful and there was spit coming out of his mouth. And I was just like, I'm a camera prodigy. Like I've got this. I'm amazing at this. And that just sort of gave me the encouragement to kind of continue to shoot and continue to explore that. I couldn't replicate that photo for years. Mm-hmm. I really don't know like what happened with that first photo, but I just like kind of like nailed it. And I spent the next, you know, several years like trying to figure out how do you not only like control the camera technically, but how do you capture moments like that? Mm-hmm. How do you really like capture expressions? How do you get that close to people? How do you really absorb energy into this medium? And so that was, like I said, I spent years, you know, trying to repeat that and finally got it, you know?
Yeah, what are those ingredients? Because I'm very new to photography. Like, I've only been shooting for maybe, like, 3 to 4 years now. Yeah. And, like, I grew up, like, I drew and, like, I did art and, like, dabble with music here and there, but didn't really get into photography until I was, like, trying to get into creative agencies and, like, photography is like the language of the creative industry. It's like, yeah, moving images and still images. So picking that up, similarly, like I had a moment when like I was learning at this kind of like internet marketing kind of like agency, and it was like, all right, well, they got nice cameras here. It's like, I better learn how to do this. Little be known, it's like I've had a Canon 60D for the last 10 years because I graduated with like an art degree, but I just never, there was this like dissonance that I had with the tool, yeah, that whatever fear I had, like I just didn't learn how to use it. And right, this was the first time where I actually like learned how to use it. And I remember my very first like quote unquote good photo was, I was on the Max and I was standing with the camera in my hand and there was a woman facing the other way, but she had her daughter on her shoulder, yeah, or just kind of like on her lap. And then like the daughter peeked over at me and it was my first time like being in that moment, looking the little baby in the eyes, pulling up the camera and just snapping this photo, and all my settings were off. So it was completely like washed out and dark, and I had to like up the exposure in Photoshop. And then when I got it, I was like, that's it. Like that's the moment right there. And, yeah, and what have you found over the years that kind of like allows you to get those intimate moments when you have that connection with like the subject and everything's just like happens and it's just like, yo, like in that split second, everything just lined up perfectly.
Yeah. I don't know. It's complicated and it happens really rarely. Mm-hmm. I spend my entire career chasing those moments and I've maybe experienced it 10 times. When you get it, you feel it go through your whole body. Mm-hmm. You know, when I got that picture of that man in Istanbul, you know, I met some guys at a cafe and they asked me, do you want to go to a soccer game? And I was like, yeah, of course I want to go to a soccer game, soccer match in Istanbul. It was a match between Beşiktaş and Galatasaray, their rivals. And like in a culture like that, like soccer has got political meanings, you know, like a match like this is dangerous. They were like, show up, wear all black and don't talk.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause nobody can know that you're an American, you know, it was like that kind of thing. And, when I came into the stadium, people were like screaming and they were like, just scream. It doesn't matter what you say, just scream with the fans. And like, they were literally breaking off pieces of concrete from the side of the stadium and throwing them at the other rival fans. And it was just this, this insane atmosphere. And the guy that was chanting was leading the chant for the section that we were in. And the people that lead the chants are actually like political activists in their, mm-hmm. in their communities. And they're chanting, you know, like this, the rival team will be devoured by bears. Like they're saying like really aggressive stuff. Yeah. And so, for me to pull out my camera, to be bold enough to take a picture in this environment, took fearlessness and navigating extreme discomfort. And I think all of those things, that environment, understanding the culture enough that, that I'm in, being present, completely present out of fear in the, in this case, all of those things, like sort of that entire atmosphere led to me getting a good photo.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to put myself in those situations. I've realized now, like me taking that photo was disrespectful. Me taking that photo was me being completely out of pocket, completely out of line, because that's not my culture. That's not, that's, those are not my stories to tell.
Mm.
And so I do that in my own, in my own community, in spaces where I belong now. But I still try to replicate that, that intensity. And I still try to replicate that, that, that energy.
Yeah. So do you still hold that belief that it, that you are out of pocket if you go into another culture? Because it's like, I love travel, like street photography is like, that's like my heart when it comes to mm-hmm. just photography in general. Cause it's like, miss me with like a studio, like set up and manicure yeah. everything. But being in like Mexico and like being on the street and like looking people in the eyes. And sometimes like, I don't have time to like ask like, puedo tomar una foto, like I, like sometimes I do, but then sometimes I don't. But do you still hold that belief, like if you're in like Thailand or something and it's just like, oh, I'm not gonna shoot?
It's complicated. It's complicated. I was just in Morocco and I took a bunch of photos there. I think it's cool to take photos. It's like, what are you doing with them?
Yeah.
Are you profiting off of these photos?
Sure.
Are the people in the photos profiting off of them? Do you know their name? Are they getting any credit for it? Like all of, you know, we're in a different time than we were even 5 years ago when I was doing street photography. Now consent is a big thing, you know, acknowledging people's trauma is a big thing. And these are questions that I have to ask. It, it's so complicated and so fraught that, I've just sort of taken a pause on doing street photography in any kind of meaningful way. Like when I was Istanbul, I only took pictures of people that gave me consent, you know, because they were like street vendors, you know, there could be like political implications if their photo turns up somewhere that it's not supposed to be. A lot of these people don't want attention for religious reasons. You take a picture of a woman in a hijab, that's like a big no-no. You can get in trouble for that. Like know the culture that you're in and understand what you're doing. I see so many, you know, sort of National Geographic kind of inspired photographers that go to less privileged countries and just like take pictures of people on the street begging for money, people with dirty hands, vendors, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, is that your entire experience of this place?
Yeah.
It's very tasteless. Yeah. I'm like, what's modern here? What's the street culture like? What are the kids doing? What is sport like in this place?
Mm-hmm.
All you went and did was take a picture of a dude that was like, you know, selling roses in the middle of the, of traffic, you know, like, so I think about it. I think about it a ton. There was a time where I was taking pictures at, arapeos and Mexican rodeos. And I was taking pictures of escaramuzas. And that was something that I was interested in, kind of by default, because I was trying to capture black cowboys and there aren't any in Oregon. There's no black rodeos like anywhere nearby. And so I was like, I want to be shooting this content like more often. And there's a ton of Mexican rodeos going on in Oregon. So I started going to those and was really excited about the culture, really, really was invited in. You know, people were excited for me to be there. Oftentimes I'd be the only photographer there. And I just started to realize that like, I didn't understand what was going on. The sport was different. people were dancing in the arena while there were bulls running around, you know? There were like mountains of Modelo like piled up to your ankle on the ground. Like it was just it culturally felt like I was consuming it and not participating in it.
Wow.
And that made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It made me feel like I don't really know. I can come here and get down. I can come here and participate. I can come here and take pictures, but I don't necessarily know that I should be profiting off of them.
Yeah. What was your very first Black American rodeo?
So I went to a rodeo in 2015. A friend of mine, Charles Perry, invited me to go with him because he was making a documentary. He said, I'm making a documentary about Black cowboys. And I kind of laughed at him. So I was like, there's no Black cowboys, you know, Black cowboys, like Sheriff Bart and Blazing Saddles and Cowboy Curtis on Pee Wee's Playhouse. Like, I was like, it's not a real thing. And he was like, no, it's very real. And you gotta come see this. So I flew to Oklahoma City, drove to a little town called Okmulgee, which is about an hour and a half away. Got out of my car. It was 105 degrees that day. There were chiggers biting my ankles. You know, there were grasshoppers jumping up on my clothes. And there were at least 2,000 Black cowboys there, you know. And it was like not like any cowboy that I had ever seen. They were wearing basketball shorts and Jordans, and they had on chains and braids, and they were walking around, you know, hitting on women and talking trash to the other riders, you know, and there were old men, you know, that sort of looked like cowboys. They had on like, you know, starched white button downs that were so crisp they like crunch when they move their arms. And they had on Stetsons, but they had on like pinky rings and like trim mustaches, and they were just like kind of doing it a little bit different. You know, their boots were ostrich, you know, like really, really nice with like silver caps on the toe and stuff like that. The women were bedazzled from head to toe. They had, you know, long braids and acrylic nails, and they were like barrel racing like in this really fancy way. The rodeo started, and you know, instead of the American flag, they carried out the Pan-African flag. And they sang Lift Every Voice and Sing, and people had the same reverence for those icons as they do for like the, you know, your standard American icons. And I realized that being there in Okmulgee, half of the people there were from Kansas City, Kansas. Half the people there came from Kansas City for their family reunions. And so there were a lot of folks that like grew up in the same neighborhood that I grew up in and went to the same high school as me, and that knew my sister and knew my grandma. And like, I was just kind of like, this is a part of where I'm from. This is a part of my heritage. It's not anything that I really paid much attention to, even though growing up we would go to the rodeo, even though growing up we would go to Benjamin Ranch and ride horses, even though growing up you know, I knew people in high school that raised chickens and raised cows and stuff like that. You would see Black men in boots and hats. I just never like paid any attention to that, because that wasn't my focus. That wasn't sort of in my range of interest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But going to that rodeo really brought it home.
Yeah. That's fucking amazing. Yeah. Like that's like, I got goosebumps as you're saying that. 'Cause oh shit. So after that first rodeo, or probably during that, like processing a lot of things and connecting a lot of dots, like, what did you leave there with, kind of like knowing that this was going to be something much greater than just a one-off thing? Because it's like, oh, like my high school friends and family and stuff are involved in this. And what gave you, I guess, like more like the curiosity and the enthusiasm to keep digging?
I didn't think much of it. I didn't process it at the time. At the time, I was like, it was cool. You know, I was mainly worried about, like, I had borrowed my mom's car, and I had, like, cow manure on my boots. And I was like, man, she's going to be so mad because I didn't realize it until I got in her car, and the car, like, stank. And, you know, I was just thinking about like logistical stuff like that. The police were following me in and out of town. There were a lot of like gangs at the rodeo, and you know, they started fighting toward the end of it. You know, so I was just like sort of, I think so in the moment that I really wasn't able to like really process the meaning of anything.
Sure.
Or the quality of what I had captured, or like what I was going to do with it. Like I went there because a filmmaker said, you got to see this. And so I just went there to experience the thing. I wasn't going as like a journalist or anything like that. I got home and I uploaded the photos, and I was just like blown away by the color and the vibrancy and the energy that I had captured. These photos were so beautiful. I took a picture of a rodeo queen named Jasmine Marie, and she's, asked her to take her picture, and she threw her hair off of her shoulders, and she's standing there with her sash and her tiara, like glistening in the stadium lights. And she's got her chin up and her hair is blowing back, and she like looks like actual royalty. And there's all this, these horses and rodeo like going on all around her. And I was like, what is this? This is amazing. You know, I just like had photo after photo after photo that just looked like a world that I had never experienced. And so I took those photos and had some urgency at that point to document all of the stories that I had captured. All of the, everybody is a storyteller. And so you meet these people and they'll talk to you for an hour about sort of their experience, or, you know, they're happy to tell you about what's going on in rodeo. And so I had all of these anecdotes and I had all of this content, and I just felt this urgency to write it down. And I stayed up for like 2 days, just like tagging every single photo with the person's name and a quote about that moment. And I like uploaded it to Behance and then just forgot about it and just went on, you know, doing street photography for a while. But it just sort of was nagging at me for months. And I was just sort of like, what was that? What did I do? I think the post on Behance got like 10 likes, something like that. It went nowhere.
Yeah.
I don't even think I posted it on social media or anything. I wasn't really doing Instagram at the time. After about a year, I was just sort of Googling like black cowboys. There wasn't a ton of interest. Like you said, it's part of like zeitgeist now. Like it's a big part of like cultural narrative. And there wasn't a lot of content at the time, but I was Googling events and I came across Arizona Black Rodeo, and I was like, there's a rodeo in Arizona. Like, I got to go to that. So I talked to the same filmmaker guy that invited me to go to Oklahoma, and he was like, oh, I'm going to be in Arizona. And I was like, well, get me a press pass. Like, I'm coming. And I went and shot that rodeo. It was completely different than the Okmulgee rodeo. The rodeo in Oklahoma was very black and white. You know, people don't wear a lot of colors. There's just dirt, brown skin, blue jeans, and white shirts. And so it's also very hot. So everybody's wearing white. The rodeo in Arizona, people were wearing teal and pink, and it was just like bright, and there was dust in the air because it hadn't rained in forever. So it was just like this entirely different atmosphere. The cowboys in Arizona were very like flashy, a lot of jewelry. They were just sort of a little bit more Hollywood in the way that they talked, like
West Coast cowboys.
Yeah. It was just like West Coast, and I was just like, wow, this is very different. So that led me to be like super curious, like what are rodeos like across the country? Like, how many are there? And so I started to get into like the Bill Pickett rodeo circuit, which is a touring black rodeo that goes all around the country. They have them in Maryland and Oakland and Denver. They go everywhere. And so I started going to those. At this point, I'm fully in it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to rodeos, going to like 8 a year, something like that. At that point, my wife is like, hey, what are you doing? she's like, this is expensive.
Yeah.
And she's like, the photos are great, but you're not doing anything with them.
Yeah.
You're not doing anything with them. So she's like, why don't you start an Instagram? So I started an Instagram. And once I started the Instagram, like, people immediately were like, That's it. What is that?
Yeah, yeah.
I want more. And then I ramped up from like 8 rodeos to like 14 or 15. Then I think last year I probably went to like 30.
Wow.
I just kind of keep escalating and keep getting more obsessed about the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, that's just sort of how it built.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you've learned about like Black rodeos and Black rodeo culture? Like that you've witnessed going from city to city to city and kind of the history of Black rodeo?
So Black rodeo is tied into Black culture in a really interesting way. During slavery, you know, like, it was illegal for Black people to ride horses.
Mm-hmm.
But in Texas, you had Black cowhands. They would wrangle cattle on foot. And they would try to keep the cows around. There weren't fences. The barbed wire hadn't been invented yet. Mm. And so you had like your cows and you try to keep them in a certain area, but you would just have to have these like cow hands that just like manage your herd. And there really wasn't a meat industry because there wasn't refrigeration. Like, things were really like simple until the Civil War. All the white men left, and the Black men were just the enslaved people were there to manage these herds, these massive herds of cattle. And without horses, they kind of, all the cows just spread out across the country and intermingled with each other.
Mm.
And they were just like these roves of cattle. The enslaved people eventually took ownership of the entire ranch. They started to ride horses. They started to manage the herds better. And when the white folks came back, the Civil War ended, and all of the enslaved people, you know, left. They went on about their lives. The former enslaved people owners couldn't manage their herds, and so they hired them back.
Mm.
Now they were paid to do the work that they were doing for free. And that's where you kind of get the first Black cowboys. And then those cowboys moved herds. You know, you would move an entire herd from Texas all the way up to Chicago.
Yeah.
Because there was no refrigeration. There were no trains. And so that's what these cowboys were employed to do. And they were rough and they were mean and they had guns and they would get into fights. They weren't allowed to go into saloons as they were like riding around. Like, and you get like legends like Nat Love that kind of come out of that. Mm-hmm. Nat Love really is the Black cowboy, because he could read and write.
Mm.
And so he documented, you know, his story. Nat Love.
The Harder They Fall, the movie.
That's not true, but okay. Yeah, sure, he's in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he's a central character in it. And there's a reason, because Nat Love is, again, he's the holder of all of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're true or not, you know, that's up to debate. Some of it's true, some of it he made up, like, clearly. And so all that having been said, they're sort of wrangling cattle across the country, bringing them to place, and then barbed wire gets invented. And you no longer need people to kind of keep these big herds together in Texas. And then the train comes around and they can sort of move cattle on train. And then refrigeration comes along and they can slaughter the cattle in Texas and then just send the meat mm-hmm. as far as New York. And so the cowboy no longer needs to exist. It sort of goes away. Then comes somebody like Nat Love. Didn't want to be a butler. He didn't want to be an elevator operator. He didn't want to be he didn't want to work on the railroad. He's a rough and tumble cowboy. And so they started to do exhibitions of their cowboy skills.
Mm.
And they started to rope and show how they wrestled steer. They started to do like shooting competitions. And then they would sort of put all of those skills together into what they called the rodeo. And so Nat Love, you know, went on to be one of the best Bronco riders in the entire West. They called him Deadwood Dick. And he, and he, yeah, and he had, like, you know, the highest score riding Broncos ever. You get Bill Pickett, who, you know, would invented steer wrestling, because he would ride his horse up along a steer, jump off the horse, bite the steer on the lip, and then wrestle it to the ground.
Wow.
You know, you have all of these legends of these rough, kind of cowboys, but they were doing all of their skills for entertainment, mm-hmm. rather than for being paid directly as cowboys. So this is a long story, but it speaks to the present, in that, like, for a long time, you know, there was a separation between white and black rodeos. Black rodeos needed to exist because black people couldn't compete in white rodeos. Mm-hmm. And so they came up with their own rodeos, mostly in Oklahoma and Texas, because that's where, you know, a lot of these folks came from. And that's why you have black rodeos today. Mm-hmm. You know, I will tell this entire story until I'm blue in the face, because I run into white folks all the time that are like, why do you have a black rodeo? Why can't we have white rodeos? You know, that would be racist if we had a white rodeo. Why do you have black rodeos? And I'm like, black rodeos exist because of a legacy and a lineage of hatred and exclusion. Black rodeos exist out of necessity, mm-hmm. you know, out of necessity for these folks that wanted to kind of show off their skills and profit off of them for the first time in their histories. A lot of these black rodeos have run continuously for 100 years.
Yeah, that part right there is like what I've kind of like taken in. I'm just like, because it's like the legacy gets carried from generation to generation to generation, and it's like you see young kids that are taking up the mantle and keeping the history alive, and then just how like widespread across the United States it is. I remember I went to New Orleans, like, I don't know, like 10 years ago, and it's like, it was around Mardi Gras, and it's like, I'm like over on Canal Street, and then there's a dude on a horse riding sideways, and it's Crip walking down the street. I'm like, where'd this dude get a horse from? And it's like, I see videos online, it's like Philadelphia, Baltimore, like all over the place, there's black cowboys, and there's these stories that are being told in this culture that's being preserved, and it's like the ones that are like grandparents and great grandparents, and it's like giving it to their kids. But yeah, that part of it, it's like, no, we're not letting this die at all, and it's never going anywhere. Like, no. It's gonna be here forever, and that's something that's beautiful. Something that I before like we even started talking was, or something that I wanted to ask was kind of like, what have you observed like with the relationship between the cowboys, cowgirls, and like the actual like animals that are there? Cause it's like, I feel like it's like a family. It's like, it's a give and take. It's not like I own you type of thing. It's like they're working together. It's like horses are intelligent animals. Cows are, and bulls are intelligent animals. And I feel like there's a relationship, a give and take that is built off of respect, that oftentimes goes unsaid. Like, people don't even talk about it. It's like, oh yeah, it's just like the cowboys and they're running the show. But it's like, no, it's like they're caring for these animals as they're working together to put food on both of their plates.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, you mentioned Philadelphia, you mentioned like California, there's the Compton Cowboys down there. Mm-hmm. I've met them. You know, all of, like you said, all of these communities came out of necessity. All of these communities have existed for a long time. Compton was farmland when it was instituted, and it's still, you know, the founder of Compton said that this will always remain farmland. And so every house has like acreage behind it. it's really weird because you're like, I'm in Compton. I'm, you know, this is the danger zone. Like, I'm in trouble. And then like you see like chickens and goats and horses like behind a lot of people's houses. Mm-hmm. And so I met Randy Savvy down there, and I was taking some pictures of him, and he's just sort of like walking around with the horse, and beautiful horse. It looks like an Arabian. Like, it's got a really thick neck, like tall. Luxury horse. He said everybody that he knew was like getting like nice cars, and so he was like, "I'm gonna get a nice horse. I'm gonna get a flex." He's like, "I'm gonna flex on this beautiful horse that I got." And so I was like, "Put a saddle on the horse, ride it around." He's like, "Oh, we don't do saddles." And I was like, "Why not?" And he's like, "Because the horse doesn't, you know, want a saddle. I don't ride the horse like a long distance." He's just like, you know, I think of the horse more like a pet. Mm. He's like, I don't even need to ride it at all. I'm not like exploiting this animal for anything other purpose other than to like take care of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that was like the most humane thing that I'd ever heard anybody say in this entire world. Like, the riding clubs are very much like, I just enjoy my horse and me and my horse, just like have love for each other, and that's the end of sort of that relationship. In rodeo, you know, especially with like a barrel racer, Kenesha Jackson and Courtney Solomon are two barrel racers down in Houston, and they just like have a bond with their horse that's like completely uncommon. Like, before a race, they'll just like ride their horse around really slowly in a circle, mm-hmm. for a long time, just getting that connection, just getting the footsteps and the rhythm like together. And then when they ride like 40 miles an hour around these barrels, and it's just like a dance. They ride in this cloverleaf pattern, and you know, Courtney Solomon was going really fast on her horse, and I was like, man, you're fast. You know, she's 11, and she's like, it's not about how fast you go, it's how smooth you ride. And she was just like, it's about like knowing when to speed up, knowing when to slow down, like,
yeah,
communicating with your horse. They don't use a crop, they don't kick the horse, they don't do any of that. The horse just like knows the rhythm,
yeah,
and they have like silent communication with the reins on how to make it go.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen, you know, bull riders pray with the bull before they ride, you know, touch the bull and pray that the bull is safe. Mm-hmm. Pray that the bull performs well, because like you said, if the bull performs well, that bull gets to continue to live.
Yeah.
If the bull performs badly, he's carne asada, like literally.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you want the bull to do well. It's kind of the best life for a bull to be a competitive bull.
Yeah.
Because they if they do well, they're really highly valued, they get to live a long life, and then after they're done competing, they get studded, they get bred,
yeah,
you know, for years.
Yeah, and like, so, Bodacious.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
that's like my favorite bull of all time, like, yeah, growing up, like, as like, I don't know what drew me to bulls, but like Bodacious was like the one bull that kind of like, I actually have like a vintage like Wrangler shirt with Bodacious on the back of it, because that was like the dude.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's famous bull.
Yeah, like, Bodacious, Bushwhacker.
Yeah, crazy bulls. Yeah, yeah, so like the relationship between the animals and just like the intelligence of horses and bulls, and it's like there's something much deeper going on, like outside of just like, oh yeah, like Black Cowboy is cool and stuff, but it's just like there's two parts to the equation. Mm-hmm. It's like the animals play such a large role, the whole equation.
A competitive bull, and I didn't learn this until I was in it, like I don't really eat meat. And so like when I started going to rodeos, I was like, wait, this is crazy. This is animal cruelty. I hate this.
Mm.
And as I started to, and some of it is, some of the sports are just terrible. They shouldn't exist.
Mm.
But like bull riding, the bulls are trained to buck. They don't naturally do that. Mm. That's not a natural action. I've been around like PBR level like bulls that are like bred with Bodacious, bred with like a bunch of other lineages of super aggressive bulls. Mm-hmm. These are killers.
Yeah.
Like violent bulls. And I've been in a pasture with them and walked up and pet them on the nose.
Yeah.
Fed them out of my hand. They're gentle until you get on their back.
Mm-hmm.
then they've been trained to do that. They have a mechanical dummy that they put on these bulls when they're like one. And if the bull kicks the dummy off, they get a treat. If they don't, they don't. Mm. And they don't get electrocuted. They don't squeeze their genitals. They don't do any of the stuff that people say that they do. They're trained to jump in certain patterns. They're trained to switch directions. They're trained to jump on four legs, like all of that stuff. So when a good trained bull, if you watch them, watch a PBR event, you'll see when they sit on the bull's back, the bull doesn't do anything in the chute. It just sort of sits there. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as the door opens, the bull jumps around, gets the guy off his back, and then it doesn't run around the arena like going crazy.
Yeah,
he just goes right back in the door.
Yeah, he just trots right back.
Yeah. So it's trained to do all of this. And if the bull is well trained, it doesn't like get like crazy anxiety. It knows what's going on. It knows that it's not in any danger. And so, you know, there are rules in place in bull riding, like the 8-second rule, which is the name of the
yeah, whip. I was gonna, see, you said I was going to like lay it up. I was going to be like, what's the significance of 8 seconds?
Yeah. 8 seconds is how long you have to ride a bull to get a qualifying score. And that rule is in place so that, after 8 seconds, the bull starts to get stressed out and fatigued.
Mm-hmm.
And they have that rule in place for the animal safety,
mm-hmm.
like singularly. You can't put your spurs into the bull. If you cut the bull with your spurs, you get a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it several times, you get disqualified. You can't touch the bull with your hand. If you do that, you get disqualified. Like there's just a lot of rules in place for animal safety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not ideal. If you're PETA, like there's nothing that you can do to make this like humane enough.
Sure.
But in the world of rodeo, in the world of like these legacies and these heritages that have existed for hundreds of years, like understanding that this is an extension of farm practice, I think is really interesting. And it goes into like really understanding the culture that you're shooting. Mm-hmm. It's super easy to judge it. That was one thing about Mexican rodeos that I judged, because at a Mexican rodeo, at a Mexican bull riding event, they do not have an 8 seconds rule. They do not have a one hand in the air rule. They ride the bull until it falls down in the ground.
Mm.
And then the bull will get up and then they'll ride it down into the ground again. And I was just like, oh, this is awful.
Mm-hmm.
These people are cruel. And I had to check myself and be like, you don't understand what you're looking at. Nobody invited you here.
Yeah.
You don't understand the culture behind this. I don't know. And it's not really my place to judge,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Can we dive into 8 seconds and yeah. what this project means for you and kind of like your legacy and moving forward and what you want it to be and what it can be?
Yeah. You know, that's a complicated one. I've just sort of gone with it organically for years. I've sort of gone like, what does the work want me to do versus what do I want it to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I always wanted to make a book. I felt like the work deserved that, to be off of the internet and to be in something like more permanent.
Yep.
I felt like the work deserved to be bigger than an Instagram post.
Yep.
And so we got the book coming out. It's called 8 Seconds. And I wanted to, I think the work wanted to celebrate the athletes in the photos. I try as best I can to get everybody's name and to tag them whenever I post a photo. It sounds simple enough, but a lot of people don't do that.
Sure.
And they're just sort of like, here's a photo of a person, versus like, this is a picture of Curry Hines. He's a calf, a roper. You should know him. He's a good looking guy. He's nice. You know, he takes care of his family. And he's a friend of mine, you know, like really, really going beyond just like, here's a photo that I took. I own this photo. I can do whatever I want, and giving him credit. Beyond that, I started working with brands like 2 years ago because I was like, if I'm going to amplify this work, if I'm going to get it out to the world, there's no better platform than like a Western brand who already has this audience. Mm-hmm. And so Wrangler came to me in 2020 and they were like, hey, we want to work with you. We want to do a project about Kenesha Jackson and Courtney Sullivan. And I was like, all right, that's cool. What does Kenesha Jackson and Courtney Sullivan get? You get two of the most credible barrel racers that there are, two of the most credible black barrel racers that they are. They not only compete in Bill Pickett, they've won numerous Bill Pickett's. They compete in the PRCA and WRCA, like the big like white rodeo leagues. And there's no black women like doing that in barrel racing. So I was like, if you're gonna talk to them, you gotta pay them. So we got them paid. I was like, none of this influencer stuff, you know, they don't need likes. Kenesha's got a private account. Like she's not looking for likes. She's not looking for free jeans. You got to pay them cash. So I made sure that I got that done for them. And then, got them in talks with the sponsorship team. And Kenesha ended up getting sponsored by Wrangler. I'm not going to take credit for that, but I just helped make the introduction. Sponsorship is critically important in the rodeo space because it costs an enormous amount of money to compete mm-hmm. in rodeo. You have to travel every single week. You can't have a full-time job and you have to travel with four horses, a trailer, a truck, you know, dually truck probably costs $90,000. A nice trailer probably costs $100,000. Feed for the horses. You have to have a hotel. You have to pay your rodeo fees. Like it's crazy expensive. You have to have $100,000 in your pocket to compete for a rodeo season. Mm. The only way that you can do that is by having a rich daddy or by having a sponsor. And so, and black people, black rodeo athletes haven't traditionally had any sponsorship whatsoever. The brands don't like them. You know, I've heard barrel racers say, Wrangler didn't want to sponsor me because they said that they don't make jeans for my body type, you know, literally. And so going in and helping to change some of that is something that I'm proud that 8 Seconds has had some little part. Mm-hmm. You know, we've gotten three or four athletes introduced to sponsorship mm-hmm. and want to continue to do that. You know, 8 Seconds is never going to like die. I don't think, you know, the athletes love it. The athletes love the platform. They're proud to be featured on it. The brands love it because nobody else is really doing this work at this level. I am not a cowboy. And so at some point I want to move on and go on to my next project. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that I'll ever not do it because I love it so much, but it will at some point not be my primary focus mm-hmm. and it'll just sort of be like a moment in time.
Yeah.
And that's really what I'm hoping that the book will do is say like, this happened mm-hmm. and this happened at a huge level. And here's the artifact, to prove it.
Yeah. The artifact to prove it. Yeah. Yeah. For most definitely. And to like, be guided by like the purpose, but it's like you're saying that it's guiding you and you're not stepping in with your ego and what has to be done here. It's just like just being there is the thing. It's like showing up and capturing what you see and helping tell these stories is so important. And I think a lot of people out there are like searching for like kind of like that higher calling, and it's like to kind of just stumble into it on a whim and just allowing it to unfold organically. It's like, that's like goals right there. Cause yeah. it's like putting in effort to create meaningful work. It just doesn't seem right that anyone should be like struggling to try to make something that's already so beautiful. And for you to find that, like, is an awesome thing. And thank you so much for sharing it with everybody.
Yeah. I think it, you know, at some point I did have a lot of like ego. I was like, I want to be, you know, 2020 Gordon Parks. Like, mm-hmm. I want to be known and I want credit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had a real, real solid vision of like what 8 seconds was and what it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of realized that that vision was so narrow and so like driven by self that I wasn't giving the subject matter the credit that they deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, very consciously just like kind of stepped back and just like went like, it's not about you, man. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need to watermark your photos. You don't need to gas up yourself. Yeah. You need to celebrate and talk about the folks in the photos. Like when a photo gets, you know, 2,000, 3,000 likes, like it's not because of anything that I did. It's because the person in the photo is cool as hell. And they're on a really, really good looking horse and mm-hmm. they're living a life that's like authentic. Like I've taken beautiful photos of not much and it hasn't gotten the reception as a photo of like Jadea Kirsch, you know, who's a black cowgirl, gets. And that's because she exudes and emanates like authenticity and energy that like people feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, it's about her. It's not about my work.
Yeah. There's a like a level of freedom and ease once we get out of the way. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of the times it's like that's the simplest thing, but it's also like the hardest thing at some points is just to get out of the fucking way and just like allow things to be. So this is a slight detour, but what are you shooting on?
I for a long time shot on a Fuji XE1. Mirrorless camera with a 32 millimeters ICE lens, and I did all of my street photography on that camera and shot, you know, most of my first rodeos with it, and I love it. I still have it. But as I started to up the level of the work and move more into commercial work, I just wanted it to look a little bit different. I wanted the photos to have a little bit different atmosphere. And so I started shooting on a GFX 50 medium format camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like people are like, why you shoot on medium format? Like they're just big, big files. And then you're like putting them on Instagram. Like that's crazy. You got like 100 megabyte file. Like that's unwieldy. And people are just like, if you have to ask why medium format, it's not for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because medium format just has a atmosphere. It's got a quality to it that feels different.
Yeah. I feel like there's more texture when I see it. Mm-hmm. Like it feels like you can like grains of like sand in between your fingers.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just something to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's technical. I just think it's just a vibe.
Yeah. I'm like a new member of Fuji Boys. So yeah. I just got an X-Pro 2 that I just started shooting. It's like chilling over there, but moving from like Canon first, which has great warmth, and then Sony, just because I'm easily gullible into mirrorless and realizing the battery life doesn't work and it sounds like shit and it's pale, everything's pale. But then like knowing like street photography is like my favorite like modality, like within the space of photography. It's like, there's nothing more exciting than just stepping out into like a new environment, not knowing what's around the corner and being present with whatever I see and like meeting new people. And I kind of call it like the passport to humanity. Cause mm-hmm. it's just like, you have a reason to be in any space. Yeah. It's just like, oh yeah, that's the photographer person. And fighting those walls that we build up that like when we're stepping away from photography for a while, like when you step on the street and you haven't done it in a couple of months, that anxiety that you have and like how you just kind of stand far away from people and it's like it takes a while to kind of get back into that flow. So I'm excited to like explore with that new camera.
Yeah, it's a great camera for what you're doing. I love my XE1 for street photography because it's not intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out and you do street photography with like a, you know,
2470.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like people are like, what is going on? Like, well, you know, the first question they ask you is, what are you using this for? But when I came out with my XE1 and it was all beat up and chipped and it looks like a film camera, people were just like,
yeah, he ain't doing shit.
Yeah. He take my picture. He's like, hey, come on. You know, they were very like accommodating and not worried about it. But yeah, those are all things that I love about street photography too. It's just like, you know, I actually used it as a mindfulness practice. My therapist recommended it because, you know, I had PTSD and she was just like, you know, what, you carry this camera around with you all the time. You know, what are you using it for? And I was like, mostly like a necklace. I was like, I don't use it for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, maybe, you know, you should start to use it. And as I used it, I really became more present in the moment and really observed everything around me. Like my vision just expanded.
Yeah.
And I could see a lot more. Like I started to notice people. Mm-hmm. Where they were just bodies, or I'd be like on my phone when I was walking or not paying attention at all. I would get to somewhere that I was going and not even realize how I got there. And I started to notice who wants their picture taken today. Because people see each other a long way away. You know, when you're walking and doing street photography, you notice somebody about 3 blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
And they notice you. And if they start to move slowly toward me on the sidewalk, I know that they want their picture taken. Mm. If they start to move closer to the parking meters, they don't.
Huh.
And so I could just like start to see the yaw of somebody over a period of time and really, mm-hmm. really know whether to engage with them or not, you know, just paying attention to how people have their hands, how they're holding their bags. You know, what they're doing. Is their head up? Are they engaged? Are they looking down? Are they disengaged? Mm-hmm. What did they choose to wear today? Are they just like in like plain Columbia jacket, like gear? Or are they wearing something kind of fly, you know, that they want to be recognized, you know? So all of those things, like, yeah, passport to humanity. I love that. That's exactly what it was. And it made me love and appreciate people in a way that I never have.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Damn, I can have this conversation with you all day. But is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, I just always like to try to shout out my wife, Heather, because like I like to click shutters and everything else I hate. You know, I hate communicating with people. I hate applying for grants, and I don't like social media stuff. I don't like a lot of the aspects of this project that I have to do, and she loves those aspects. Mm-hmm. And so we just like strike this balance and this harmony in the work that makes it go. So she, you know, not only like works behind the scenes with no credit like whatsoever on the project, but I'm also on the road a lot, you mm-hmm. know. I'm on the road probably 3 or 4 months out of the year in aggregate, and she's holding it down at home while I'm gone, you mm-hmm. know. She's calling me every night with the kids so we can do our prayers and put them to bed, and she's, you know, cooking the meals and never complains or like stresses me out about it. And so it really, somebody told me early on, like when I was an actor, they're like, if you want to do this, you got to find a partner that supports your lifestyle, and she's the partner that supports my lifestyle. So
wow,
yeah,
that's beautiful. I'm trying to find that too, but
it's hard.
I'll keep holding out, but I have faith. I'll pray on that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Where can people find you on the interwebs?
SECS.com, EIGHTSECS.com, 8sex, and then that's my Instagram as well.
Dope. And when does the book come out?
The book is on a boat right now. It's coming. I got 600 copies.
Dope. I'm going to get one of those.
I sold 400 of them. So
yeah, I need to move yeah. quick.
Yeah, I've got a wait list on my website, so you can sign up for that.
Dope.
And then that'll be the first edition of the book. I tried to get a publisher. You know, nobody was trying to talk to me.
Their loss.
Yeah. And so I just went ahead and did it myself. And, you know, the thing blew up. So we're excited about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Ivan. And thank you all for listening to Opening Presents.